the federal court held this morning that they were not, in fact, providing even oral language assistance.
A judge requires the state to do a better job translating election materials. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government mishandles Alaska Natives' applications for exemptions from the health care law.
Every time we call, it's a bear with us sort of request, but we've been bearing with them since February when we first started reporting issues.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A federal district court judge has sided with plaintiffs who say the state is not doing enough to help non-English-speaking voters. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a partial decision today in a case against the State Division of Elections is aimed at protecting the voting rights of Alaska Natives.
In Toyokok versus Treadwell, plaintiffs argued that translation of State of Alaska ballot language from English into Yupik is not adequate to ensure voters' understanding of the ballot. Four tribal councils filed the suit against the State Division of Elections last year, alleging the state violated the Voting Rights Act and the United States Constitution by not providing language assistance to Yupik and Gwich'in-speaking voters in three census areas. State attorneys argued that because the languages are historically unwritten, the Voting Rights Act requires only oral language assistance in these languages. The Division of Elections said it provides translators and bilingual poll workers. In a hearing today before a federal judge in Anchorage, Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth argued for the plaintiffs.
But the federal court held this morning that they were not, in fact, providing even oral language assistance, because they don't ask or pay their outreach workers in the villages or bilingual poll workers to translate any of the information in the official election pamphlet. That was part of her holding today.
Landreth says plaintiffs want written information translated. Under the current system, Yupik-speaking voters do not get a written election pamphlet in advance of the election.
If you're a Yupik-speaking voter, the translated information that you receive consists of three things. Here's the day of the election, here's the time of the election, here's where it'll be, and then there will be language assistance available at the polling place. There is no advance information about the candidates, no advance information about bond measures, nothing about constitutional questions, nothing about ballot measures. To such a degree that the plaintiffs and other witnesses testify, the first time they find out about ballot measures is often when they go in to vote on election day.
Federal District Court Judge Sharon Gleason sided with plaintiffs in a partial decision today, which addresses only the Voting Rights Act claims. Gleason said the Division of Elections has violated the act by not providing substantially equivalent language assistance in Yupik and Gwich'in in the three census areas. The court has given the state until this Friday to provide a proposal for additional language assistance measures that could be implemented in time for the November election. Alaska Assistant Attorney General Corey Mills says that time is running out.
The court also recognized the difficulty that the Division of Elections has in providing this type of assistance. So the state and basically the Division of Elections and Department of Law, you know, are currently looking at that and what that proposal will entail.
The court did acknowledge the state's efforts so far in providing ballot translations for Yupik and Gwich'in speakers, saying the state has been working diligently this year in providing language assistance. Native American Rights Fund attorney Landreth says the plaintiffs have until September 10th to respond to the state's proposal. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Most Americans are supposed to have health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, but up to 50,000 Alaska Natives and American Indians in Alaska are excused from the requirement. They have to apply for that lifetime exemption, though, and the federal government is mishandling many of those applications. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Evelyn Burdick thought it would be easy to apply for her American Indian exemption. As a member of the Cherokee Nation, the Anchorage resident sees a doctor at the Alaska Native Medical Center. Burdick likes the care she gets there and has no plans to sign up for private insurance under Obamacare. So she sent an exemption application to the federal government almost as soon as it was available earlier this year.
And it's a very short, little two-page form with a signature page that I filled out and sent in on January 9th of this year, and have yet to receive any correspondence back from them whatsoever, not even to let me know that they received my application.
Burdick is not alone. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has helped hundreds of Alaska Natives and American Indians in the state who have had problems with their exemption applications. The exemption is a simple 6-digit number applicants need for their tax forms to avoid paying a penalty for not having health insurance. Monique Martin with ANTHC has been working with the federal government to resolve the problems.
Every time we call, it's a bear with us sort of request, but we've been bearing with them since February when we first started reporting issues, and we are anxious for a resolution to this issue.
The federal government has fumbled the applications in several different ways. Martin works closely with three other people at ANTHC who all applied for the exemption for themselves. Martin's exemption number came back with no problems, but her three colleagues were not so lucky.
One of our coworkers received her letter twice with two different sets of exemption numbers for her and her kids. One received the wrong exemption. She sent in the appropriate documentation to get the Indian exemption, but she received the hardship exemption. And another one is still waiting to hear on her application. So we've seen all the errors come to us as, you know, folks that are assisting people. So we have real-world examples and errors that we can show the federal government.
No one from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services was willing to do an interview for this story. In an email, a spokesperson with the agency wrote that they are working to improve the process daily and committed to providing consumers with their exemption numbers in time for tax filing season. Martin says she's cautiously optimistic that can happen.
We are the squeaky wheel in Alaska, and we are really pushing the federal government to help resolve this issue, and that we need to get this addressed for people so they aren't negatively impacted when they qualify for an exemption.
Martin worries about how the federal government will handle the rush of exemption applications as tax time approaches. She expects many Alaska Natives and American Indians haven't even thought about sending in the application yet. Evelyn Burdick, who was proactive and applied early in the process, says the 9-month-long wait for a response has been frustrating.
Well, I don't want to be penalized for not having the healthcare.gov insurance. I mean, I'm trying to follow the rules and regulations that healthcare.gov has set up, and they're not making it any easier.
Late last month, Monique Martin was able to get Burdick's exemption number for her from a contact at the federal government. Burdick is happy to have the number, but she still wants to see it in writing. She says she has no idea when it will arrive in her mailbox, but at this rate, she's not expecting it anytime soon. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The fallout continues after U.S. Senator Mark Begich aired a campaign ad blaming his opponent for a sentencing error that freed a sex offender now charged in a double homicide. The independent website PolitiFact gave the ad a rating of pants on fire, its lowest score. The website, sponsored by the Tampa Bay Times, sided with Republican Dan Sullivan. Sullivan, a former state attorney general, says the mistake leading to the sex offender's short sentence occurred before he was appointed to be the state's top lawyer. The Begich campaign pulled the ad after the victim's family complained, and Sullivan also took down his rebuttal ad. A Begich spokesman alleged Sullivan is responsible because a prosecutor working under him signed a plea deal for an inappropriately short sentence. A later Department of Law review of the case said the state lawyers, the judge, and the corrections department all failed to see the suspect had a prior felony, which would have increased the presumptive sentence to at least 8 years. PolitiFact called it highly unlikely that Sullivan was personally involved in the plea deal. It also concluded he was not responsible because the sentence was based on an inaccurate state record created before Sullivan became attorney general. Though the ad is no longer on air, national pundits and Republican political operatives continue to draw attention to it, calling it a blunder that could damage Begich's reelection bid. still to come on Alaska News Nightly. University of Alaska Southeast students move into new dorms.
We just went upstairs and they're so nice. It's like there's an actual refrigerator and freezer, and there's just so much more room and everything's so clean.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
Sides are lining out their positions in the long-running battle over who should be in charge of cleaning up Fairbanks' air. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a twice-passed citizen initiative, which bans the North Star Borough from regulating wood and coal-burning stoves and boilers, is up for renewal in next month's municipal election.
The Home Heating Protection Act, first passed in 2010 out of concern by supporters about North Star Borough plans to clamp down on wood and coal burning, and the issue hasn't changed much over the years, according to initiative sponsor State Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole.
The whole initiative came because they made a fine schedule, and so now you're going to fine people because the air inversion has happened, and they are utilizing what they can afford to be able to stay here, and that's just a shame.
Cold air inversions trap smoke from wood and coal burning at ground level, driving wintertime fine particulate pollution that violates federal standards.
Look what we're doing to ourselves. Air quality is poor still. It's a health issue.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins wants voters to repeal the initiative and give the borough a chance to regulate emissions proven to cause health problems. He's okay with fining chronic polluters who don't respond to outreach like a borough program that pays for replacement of wood stoves and boilers with cleaner burning units. Mayor Hopkins describes fines as a common tool for curbing pollution.
They have these in all, you know, they have it in Juneau also. Not saying that we have to be like Juneau, we can be like ourselves. Local control is where members of the community can come in and address the assembly about what they want. And I think that it's passing over this air quality issue by saying we don't want to have any controls, we want to be able to burn anything we want, anytime. That's not the way to approach this.
Hopkins favors a burn ban program that would focus on people who have backup heat sources.
So that we can lower the emission levels when we have a serious inversion. That's what we need to be doing. When you have a dual home heating system, you do have a choice.
With the voter initiative in effect, air quality regulation is left up to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. The DEC is also considering requiring people with alternate heat sources to not burn wood on bad air days, but it doesn't have authority to fine those who don't comply. Its only option is taking offenders to court. Representative Wilson contends the solution ultimately has nothing to do with enforcement or who's in control.
We all know that gas is going to be the only way that we get out of the situation that we're in.
A state and private funded mega project to process North Slope natural gas, truck it south, and pipe it to Fairbanks North Pole neighborhoods is targeting initial delivery to some areas by 2016. Wilson says that, combined with local voluntary efforts, should be enough to demonstrate progress toward cleaner air.
There's over 200 people trying to upgrade their stoves through the stove change-out program. You can go around and see more people are using dry wood. They're covering it. The education portion is also working. And the state has prosecuted or began that with some of those who were burning incorrectly.
A federally required plan for getting Fairbanks into compliance with fine particulate pollution regulations is being worked on by the DEC, but it's running behind schedule. The DEC wrapped up public comment on proposed smoke measures last spring, but Air Quality Division Program Manager Cindy Heil points to heavy public input, nearly 1,000 comments, slowing the review process.
We've been doing modeling what would be the impacts of various different combinations of ideas, programs, different things that would help reduce the PM2.5.
Heil says each change of the model takes days to weeks to work through. She wouldn't estimate when the plan, due to the Environmental Protection Agency, by the end of the year might be available for public review, but acknowledges the state is pushing the timeline.
I think there's concerns, but we're still trying to be somewhat optimistic about it. I haven't given up the ghost yet, but you know, that time is obviously is getting closer and closer.
Fairbanks has to lower its 24-hour average fine particulate pollution level about 10 micrograms per cubic meter by December 2015, or risk being classified as a serious non-attainment area and face tougher regulation. Voters consider the local initiative banning the borough from regulating heating devices in the October 7th municipal election. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska's internet speeds are up 33% from last year, but the state is only one spot ahead of Arkansas for the slowest internet in the nation, according to a pending study. For the first quarter of 2014, Alaska had the slowest internet in the U.S. KTOO's Sarah Yu has more.
Alaska's internet is about half as fast as the top three states. Akamai's studies and rankings are based off of actual content, such as websites and videos, delivered to the users from their servers. David Belson wrote the study. He's Senior Director of Industry and Data Intelligence at Akamai.
The speeds that we do see, even in the slower states, are still pretty good.
The United States ranked 12th globally in internet speeds with an average of 10 megabits per second. Libya had the slowest internet speed worldwide with an average of half a megabit. Economy, population density, and geography play a large part in how fast local internet is.
Bring high-speed connectivity to a city, and you can hit a large percentage of the population there, that's a good thing. But if you have to be running it, you know, along roads and over hills and across rivers, and that all gets really expensive.
GCI and Alaska Communications are Alaska's largest internet providers. They had to run fiber optic cable underwater more than 1,000 miles from Anchorage to the lower 48. Hannah Blankenship is an ACS spokeswoman.
We're more similar to an international carrier that's connecting continents rather than a lower 48 provider that is connecting on land.
She says Alaska's large landmass and low population contributes to slower speeds. Communities off the road get internet via satellite, which is slower than cables and fiber. David Morris, a GCI vice president, says sometimes large organizations, such as the state of Alaska, hospitals, or schools, will pay to build infrastructure for faster internet. For example, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation used USDA Rural Development grant funding to upgrade 65 rural communities in southwest Alaska from satellite internet to GCI's land-based network. That meant paying for a combination of line-of-sight microwave dish relays and fiber optic cables. The healthcare provider needed faster internet to keep up with changes in a federal health privacy law. The changes limited certain healthcare communications, but allowed for specific types of video conferencing.
You've got the village health clinic that is connected to a regional hospital, and then in turn, those hospitals are connected into Anchorage as well as to lower 48 hospitals.
Once the infrastructure was there, the internet provider could offer faster internet to locals. GCI itself has spent $150 million to improve internet in rural communities, in addition to having a $44 million grant and a $44 million loan in federal broadband stimulus funding. ACS just announced it will offer 30 and 50 megabit per second home internet for Anchorage residents, and GCI is in the process of making 1 gigabit per second internet connections available to residents in Anchorage. Akamai Technologies' next study is due out this month. In Juneau, I'm Sarah Yu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Classes for the fall semester started yesterday at University of Alaska Southeast. More than 2,000 undergraduate and graduate students are currently enrolled at the university's Juneau campus. About 100 freshmen have settled into campus life at UAS's new residence hall. The $14.3 million facility opened at the end of August. KTOO's Lisa Fu was there for move-in day and has the story.
UAS student Matt Magnuson is helping his friend move into the new freshman residence hall.
We just went upstairs and they're so nice. It's like there's an actual refrigerator and freezer and there's just so much more room and everything's so clean.
His friend Delaney Jones drove 2 days from Delta Junction. She didn't want to go to University of Alaska Fairbanks because it was too close to home. On the fifth floor of the new dorm, Jones marvels at her new home.
I have my bed and it has drawers underneath, which is really convenient because the closets are like not as big as I thought they would be. And then I have such a nice view of Auk Lake and like the rest of the campus and my desk and chair. And now most of my stuff.
UAS's new residence hall can house up to 120 students in suites that feature a shared kitchen area and bathroom. Construction started May of 2013, and finishing touches were completed just before students moved in at the end of August.
Wow. Well,
two floors below, Samantha Ferguson walks into her new dorm room for the first time. The 18-year-old from central Indiana flew to Juneau by herself and traveled late. She's moving to college with only one suitcase.
It's got clothes. I had to bring travel size hygiene because my suitcase had to be 50 pounds or less. I've got blankets, and here I've got a couple of shoes, and I actually have food and laundry stuff in there.
Ferguson is studying marine biology and figured being in Juneau would be a perfect fit. She says it took her a year of working at a McDonald's in Indiana to afford moving to Alaska.
I saved more than half of every paycheck, and I worked part-time when I was in high school, and then during the summer I went to a full-time and got a raise. So I definitely saved up a lot of money.
Ferguson also took out loans and got a housing scholarship, so she doesn't have to worry about the $5,000 it costs to live in the new freshman dorm for 9 months. Upperclassmen living on campus are housed in Banfield Hall or in one of seven apartment buildings and pay up to $6,800 for two semesters. Director of Campus Life Eric Scott says cost is part of the incentive of living on campus.
In terms of being in the Juneau community, we're very competitive.
It's been about 20 years since the campus opened a new dormitory. UAS can now house about 380 students, but only 60% of the beds are filled. About half living on campus are from Southeast. A quarter comes from elsewhere in Alaska, with another quarter from 23 other states. One international student from Japan calls the UAS campus home. Scott hopes the number of students living on campus will grow.
We were close to capacity every year prior to opening this new residence hall, and so now we have the ability to add some more students on campus. And so we're hoping that some of those folks who have gone off campus for a variety of reasons will come back and join us now that we have this brand new residence hall and a really great program to surround it.
The university has staff members living in the new residence hall. Scott says there are several common areas for studying and meeting in groups,
so that students can spend time outside of their rooms, but still in the residence hall. One of the other great things, up on our fourth floor, we have a conference slash classroom where folks can meet, folks can host classes. And that's really the way that we're moving, is bringing the academic programs back into the residence halls.
As students steadily moved into the new freshman residence hall, they unpacked suitcases and boxes of belongings, quickly filling up the empty rooms and bare walls. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
It's got a Vietnam vet with a big heart and anger management problems, a small-town newspaper reporter, and a hippie radio station. Throw in some meth-fueled wildlife crime and a few cruise ships, and you have the makings of an adventure mystery set in Southeast Alaska. Dale Brandenberger is a former biologist with the state who has a new novel called Grizzly Trade. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
To speak to Dale Brandenberger, first you've got to find him. For the past 6 weeks, he's been working on a research cruise for the Sitka Sound Science Center. We finally established a scratchy connection via satellite phone as the boat he's working on, the Sitka-based Surveyor, motored out of Rodman Bay.
You know, a lot of things that you read about Alaska, it's always man versus nature struggling, and I don't really see people striving to survive so much as thriving up here, and I wanted to include Alaskan sense of humor and have some fun with the book, so hopefully it's a fun read.
And Grizzly Trade, despite its dime novel cast of cops, reporters, petty criminals, and other ne'er-do-wells, is a fun read. The protagonist is a Vietnam veteran named Red who grows frustrated when law enforcement is unable to stop the poaching of brown bears, whose paws and gallbladders are then trafficked on the Asian aphrodisiac market. Red's decision to track the poachers leads him through a series of episodes, most of which are based on events that actually happened and many remember, like a cruise ship spill involving dry cleaning and photochemicals. Brandenberger worked for ADF&G for 28 years, both in Juneau and in Sitka, and was a diligent journal writer. He's seen a lot, maybe too much, according to his wife.
Two of the incidents that I originally had in the book, she's like, no one would believe that. And they were true incidents as well. And I had to cut them from the book, otherwise my credibility would have been shot, I think.
Although the character of Red is based on a friend of his in Ketchikan, a big guy with a red beard and anger management problems, most everyone else is an amalgam of folks he has met over the course of his career. There is a newspaper reporter, however, from a town north of Sitka, whom Brandenberger says may see a bit of himself. And that hippie radio station? Well, that could be anywhere. Brandenberger set his story in the fictional town of Alcoot rather than pin all this strangeness on a specific locale.
Yeah, it gives you a little more freedom than trying to write a bunch of facts about Alaska, and it makes for a more of a page-turner, I think, for certain readers.
Brandenberger has written one previous unpublished novel, which he says was good experience for this book, plus changed his approach to writing. He's decided to not be quite so serious and to follow the lead of authors like
Carl Hyacin, who's written a lot of satirical type stuff about environmental issues in Florida, and David James Duncan, who wrote The Brothers K and The River Y.
Brandenberger says he has mined his journals of the last 30 years for material for Grizzly Trade. So much happens, readers may wonder if there's anything left for the little town of Alcoot. Brandenberger says he's already well into his next story.
It's in the same town 10 years later, and they're trying to put in a hydroelectric dam, and there's also a reality TV show that comes to town. So that's going to be fun as well. I'm having a good time writing it.
Hydroelectric dam and reality television? Now that really could be anywhere. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sarah Yu and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build, from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Public Employees Local 71 asks you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska. Alaska laborers and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities also know the importance of safe driving in construction zones. This message sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.